Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. Today we are doing a special episode because we have Daniel of the Lesser Bonafarts fame, the original boner, so to speak.
A founding boner, I suppose.
We'll be talking about the Cossacks and what do they mean, what do they stand for, what have they turned into, and a bunch of other nonsense in the meantime, because our past few episodes have been so demanding and so tiring and so serious that some people are forgetting that we're actually, you know, quite a funny podcast, actually. So, hey, Daniel, how's your life going?
It's very good, yeah. Thank you for asking. I like that if when it comes time to not be serious, you bring me on board. That's I can tell you right now, I do not take it seriously. No, it's going great. I guess since the last time that we recorded together, it may have been for that I think it was going to be a premium film commentary that would actually
it was Spies Like Us and it never aired. I watched it twice. It was terrible. Mark Sands, who sent us the movie, thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. I love you a lot. But that movie was just so terrible.
And it was our dedication to you, Mark, that we watched it through twice. Anyway, man, yeah, since then, I've had a baby. So that's been probably the biggest biggest thing going on for me. She's going to be 5 months old next week. 5 months old tomorrow.
Let's say hi to Daniel's baby.
Hi, baby. Grow up and be happy and be a good citizen of the world.
We're trying to. She's already tremendous. She is already just the greatest ray of sunshine. I'm sure she will be absolutely a marvelous citizen of the world. Thank you, Alice. Other than that, just kind of plugging away. I have I'm doing another podcast these days. It's a monthly podcast with my friend Claude Guzer. Called The Cannonball, that's C-A-N-O-N, like the Western canon, where we read some of the great works of Western literature, and kind of dumb guy, try to understand them with the help of Claude, who is an actual English professor. But that should be, if you can't get enough of Daniel content with us yakking about Cossacks, you go check out Cannonball. But yeah, man, it's been going great. It's good to be back talking with you, dude.
I've got to check your Cannonball off myself. Yeah, fun thing is, like, in Lesser Boners, when we were there, Cossacks was one of the main themes there. And you also kind of, you guys, when you and Glenn were on the show and doing your episode here about Soviet music, you mentioned Cossacks there. So, can you please tell my listeners who the Cossacks were then? Because I'm going to torture you to the maximum of my ability.
Boy, you just asked a mouthful, man. Like, what, to ask the question, who is a Cossack? You know, it touches on so many different kinds of identity, but I guess the best way to put it would be the Cossacks were, or ? I guess we'll get to that later. You'll have more to speak on that. But when we talk about Cossacks, we're talking about a sort of, a quasi-ethnic group, semi-independent military society, I guess, is a way to put it. But it sort of developed in the 1400s in kind of the borderland area between the emerging Russian princedoms in the north and the disintegrating Mongol khanates of the steppe lands. And so you had this kind of, it was sort of a no man's land, except not exactly a no man's land, because there were men there.
The Cossacks, namely.
Right.
But it's mostly what you would call southern Russia and, like, Ukraine today, I suppose. That's their main concentration.
That's their main concentration. That's where this culture basically developed. But they ended up being spread pretty far afield because they ended up becoming, of course, very useful to the czars. But of course, not until after some contentious headbutting. Because one thing you have to, I think one of the main things to remember about the Cossacks as this sort of phenomenon, as this community, there were several, you know, you'd have several different ones, and some would some hosts would disintegrate, some would stick around for a long time, some mix and match. But what brings them all, I think, you know, sort of a thread connecting it all, is this kind of a real independent streak. These were people that, and it's in the name, really, because the word Cossack is probably, like, almost certainly derived from a Turkic word, Kazakh. And that's, you know, that probably sounds familiar because, of course, we know about Kazakhstan. That's one of the, you know, it's like a Turkic-speaking people there. And it comes from the same root, which is not super flattering because it eventually goes back to a meaning something like bandit mercenary. Like, it's this kind of...
But it's pretty close. It's kind of accurate if you think about it.
Yeah,
it is
what
it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because the word Kazakh, you know, and the Kazaki, that was a line of work. It wasn't an identity. It wasn't like an ethnicity, but it was a kind of work you got into where basically you basically were a bandit, but you would also hire yourself out.
Yeah, because that's the thing. A lot of people think that Cossacks or Kazaki or Kazakhs, whatever you name them, same word. Mm-hmm. Some people think it's kind of an ethnical thing, but it's not. It's a culture. It's a culture,
exactly.
And it's a
exactly.
group. It's essentially like, I don't know, imagine a huge fraternity, except they all have guns.
Yeah, they all have guns, and they're all very good at using them.
Yeah, and at that point, by the way, if you are a Russian peasant, you are a serf.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your house burns down and you can't pay your dues or whatever and bad things happen to you, or you just don't like the serf life. So what do? Well, you can either join another group of serfs or you can run away and join the Cossacks. Because those guys are independent under the Tsar, but they're not serfs, they're free men. So, hey...
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a what I thought was pretty interesting. I was reading kind of my main source I went with was it may surprise everybody. There's not a super large amount of sort of just straight up books about the Cossacks in the English language, but I did find there was a cool one that was published fairly recently. Well, it was 10 years ago now. It was by an Irish scholar by the name of Shane O'Rourke, but he wrote a monograph on the Cossacks. It's a very kind of a broad survey, but it was really helpful for me to actually sort out, you know, to sort out, like, between actual history and, like, stereotypes. But he makes the point, like, early on, this, you know, the Cossack identity, the Cossack culture developed in the interaction, not just with, like, the Russian principalities, but also this was when Poland-Lithuania was sort of the other big suzerain empire there on that part of the steppe. And so the early Cossacks would hire themselves out to either, they were hiring themselves out to the Polish-Lithuanian dukes, they were hiring themselves out to the Russian princes or the Tsar, the Tsar of Muscovy, or they were just, you know, they just go wildcat, just go raiding on their own, you know, attacking, basically going raiding at the old remnants of the Golden Horde Khanate, the Ottomans, the Safavid Persians, you know, they get over across the Caspian Sea and sack some Persian cities.
Yeah, because, you know, even though they were formally subjects of the Tsar, essentially, mm-hmm. It was like this. If you were a Cossack, it was normally you'd expect ethnicities to be subject to the Tsar, but this is like a huge paramilitary organization, and they just like, they nominally run a bunch of territories for the Tsar. Except, you know, both Vasily III and Ivan the Terrible both wrote to the Ottomans stating that, hey, could you guys please, like, cut down the Cossacks because they are doing things terribly bad. They're raiding all over.
Right.
And they're, even though they're nominally my subjects, they do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting culture that develops as well because, like you mentioned, like a lot of the people who become Cossacks, they're there, they sort of go to the frontier because they're desperate, and that's sort of where, well, I mean, honestly, like the Tsar is, there's always work to be had on the frontier because they're, you know, the Tsar wants to hire people to defend from Tatar raids or, you know, Ottoman raids, what have you. But it becomes a kind of, you have these, so for the most part, ethnically, these would be sort of Slavic-speaking people, and but of course from all over, really. But they, because they're starting to make a life on the steppe, they're culturally adopting a lot of the steppe nomad lifestyle, a lot of the steppe nomad culture. I mean, even the name Cossack, because we, you know, like we mentioned, it's a Turkish word, it's a Turkic name. So you had this again. That's why it's a culture, not ethnicity. That if you had to pin an ethnicity on these guys, I guess it would be Russian for the most part. But would in their own sort of self-conception of identity, would they, I guess, you know, they're subjects of the Russian Tsar, but I think what's important to remember too is that they're subjects of the Tsar directly.
Yeah.
So they don't have
any noble landlords or anything.
They don't have any nobles over them, and they are very insistent on keeping it that way, which is something that the boyars don't necessarily enjoy about them.
Yeah, because you can try to tax them. Well,
yeah.
Good luck.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the sort of that their military services, they're sort of the tax rendered to the Tsar. But what's I think what was pretty cool as I was doing my reading is that one of the ways, like, they're a two-edged sword, you know, for the monarchy, like the Tsarist state to be wielding. Simply because, like, yeah, they're excellent soldiers. They have to be there. You know, they're making their life out on the steppe. Like, when they're not out raiding, they're hunting, they're fishing. They eventually start settling down and, like, doing actual farming. They sort of create these more or less settled communities. They're really kind of, they were really pioneers in settling what had been the open nomad steppe for, you know, since time immemorial, really.
Yeah, but also another important thing is that, as I checked this out, you know, in the Imperial Russia, Cossacks were better educated than the rest of the citizens.
Yeah.
Like, the level of education that they had, like, what they got from their, like, also fellow Cossack schools and whatever, it was, they had, like, more schools and, like, a greater proportion of Cossacks went to actual schools than in general in Russia.
Yeah.
So these guys aren't dumb. They're very freedom-loving, and they really just care about their own, except that, you know, Cossacks are actually kind of like Americans.
Well, it's honestly, as I was reading, I got like the I was a little unaware before I like really dug deep, like there were a lot more, and that's part, well, I guess that's part of the two-edged sword with like the Tsarist state, right? They're egalitarians among themselves. Like, they're like, you know, they had the, at least in sort of the early stages of the development of Cossack culture, it was this radical democracy that they had. Like, everything, you know, the various hosts were independent, but they would come together for like yearly grand conclaves, and they would elect a hetman or an ataman, their leader, which is a Turkic word for the leader. And they would like hash out, you know, whatever issues were at hand for the coming year. And every Cossack, it's one man, one vote. Every Cossack had the right to speak out about whatever they wanted to. They culturally had no time for any deference to a noble. They were not about to be doing any of that or that kind of hierarchy. It was a very anti-hierarchy, egalitarian kind of society. As long as you were in the Cossack group, you know, I mean, that, you know, let's not go, they're not going to extend the same graciousness to everybody, but that's part of what made them so dangerous. In addition to being so effective, is because any peasant, you know, you have the serfs, and around the time that the Cossacks are developing is also when the serfdom is really ramping up in Russia, and they have all those limits on what you can move, what you can do, and the peasants can look over at these Cossacks, and it's a different, It's like a social alternative that they see. You know, here are these people. They speak my language. They're like me. They're not any more special than me. But they don't have to bend the knee to some boyar. They aren't told what to do all the time.
Yeah, like they're not serfs.
Right.
They don't
serfs.
Have an owner who tells them what to do.
Right.
So going Cossack was like about like I can compare it to the way of like, you know, if you were like some indentured servant in like early America or something like that, then you could like probably go to the Wild West or something. Wild West or whatever. But yeah, right. Something similar to that. You go west to find adventure, have your own piece of land and do things. Except, well, here you get, you know, a piece of grazing land and you get a horse and a gun and then, you know, you do things. You're still kind of subject to the Tsar with a very on and off relationship there.
Yeah. Well, I found myself thinking that it's a little bit like the and you know, as every time you do a misleading historical analogy, like there's just as much that's not the same about these phenomena as there is the same. But I found myself thinking it's a bit like the Janissaries under the Ottoman Sultan, because that was another sort of specialized military culture that was beholden strictly to the autocrat and not to any of the other aristocracy. That they were outside of that sort of pyramid structure because they only answered to the one guy. And even then, like, you know, there were some Cossacks didn't really want to answer to that guy either. Like there was, and a few of these Cossack revolts, what I thought was very interesting with, so you mentioned these serfs. If you're a serf and you don't like, you know, you start resenting your serf life. When some of these Cossack hosts would revolt, and there are a few of them, Stepan Razin was one of the big famous ones in the 1660s that he did his big, or 1670s? Anyway, you had a bunch of sort of dispossessed peasants just declaring themselves Cossacks. Like, they would just get all together, like, it would basically be a peasant revolt, and they'd say, hey, we're Cossacks now, so boo on you, we're just gonna be Cossacks. And of course, they weren't trained in, you know, the sort of the... They weren't like part of that steppe culture. They weren't part of the frontier culture, but they just saw this, you know, Cossack army going through, telling all the nobles to go stuff themselves, and they were like, "Hell yeah, I'm a Cossack!" You know, that was fascinating. They were a symbol of liberation to a lot of these serfs.
Yeah, but you know, the most important thing is like, oh come on, if we're talking about the Cossacks, of course I'm gonna quote in full the most important piece of evidence about Cossacks that you need to know. In 1676, when, you know, those Cossacks were basically living on the borderlands of Russia, at that point, borderlands between Russia and the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Sultan wasn't very happy about this idea and about, like, you know, them being independent and about Russia existing in general. So he sent them a letter. And by the way, everyone knows kind of all the history fans should know the reply of the Zaporozhian Cossacks.
Absolutely.
But this is the original letter from Sultan Mehmed, who wanted, you know, to, you know, they're independent guys, maybe he can, like, flip them over easily and get a lot of territory. So he wrote to them, quote, Sultan Mehmed IV to the Zaporozhian Cossacks. As the Sultan, son of Muhammad, brother of the sun and moon, grandson and viceroy of God, ruler of the kingdoms of Macedonia, Babylon, Jerusalem, Upper and Lower Egypt, Emperor of Emperor, Sovereign of Sovereigns, Extraordinary Knight, never defeated, steadfast guardian of the tomb of Jesus Christ, trustee chosen by God himself, the hope and comfort of Muslims, confounder and great defender of Christians, I command you, the Zaporozhian Cossacks, to submit to me voluntarily and without any resistance, and to desist from troubling me with your attacks. Turkish Sultan Mehmed IV. And now, the most famous, probably, fuck you letter in the whole history of history is gonna come in, except that this is the heavily censored version, because you probably need to understand Ukrainian or Russian to understand it properly. Because the version I'm gonna read now is, kind of, it's known in English, but even this version that I will read now is heavily censored. Like, a lot. It is made readable, but yeah.
Yeah.
Zaporozhian Cossacks to the Turkish Sultan. O Sultan, Turkish devil and damn devil's kith and kin. secretary to Lucifer himself. What devil kind of knout are you that cannot slay a hedgehog with your naked arse? The devil shits and your army eats. You shalt not, you son of a whore, make subjects of Christian sons. We do not fear your army. By land and sea, we will battle with you. Fuck your mother. You Babylonian scullion, Macedonian wheelwright, brewer of Jerusalem, goat fucker of Alexandria, swineherd of Greater and Lesser Egypt, pig of Armenia, Podolian thief, catamite of Tartary, hangman of Kamenets, and fool of all the world and underworld, an idiot before God, grandson of the serpent and the crick in our dick, pig snout, mare's ass, slaughterhouse cur, unchristened brow, screw your own mom. So the Zaporozhians declare, you lowlife. You won't even be herding pigs for the Christians. Now we'll end this, for we don't know the date, and we don't have a calendar. The moon's in the sky, the year with the god, they the same over here as it's over there. For this, kiss our arse. Koshovi Ottoman Ivar Sirko with the whole Zaporozhian host. If this is not the greatest document ever.
Marvelous. It's absolutely terrific, and it really does like sum up the Cossack attitude at this point anyway. Like that's and the thing is, like, they weren't, man, they, a lot of those guys weren't that far off from feeling that way about
the Tsar.
Like,
yeah,
the Tsar. Like,
if the Tsar would like say, hey, you give me more tag, no. These guys were anti-authoritarian and rebellious. They were the punk rockers of the age, so to speak. And painting of Ilya Repin, the famous painter Ilya Repin. I highly recommend you check that out.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's a beautiful painting.
It's a beautiful painting which just gives you the very expression of this thing.
Yeah.
And also, this is one of the things where I can say that what explicit podcast? No. I'm quoting.
Right. This is a purely historical document. This is not for any prurient interest. Yeah, it's a very, I don't know. It's like this kind of, you get the real sense from the Cossacks that like they viewed themselves as being in alliance with the Tsar rather than subject to him. Most of the time,
they're kind of like pirates, but on the land.
If you on the sea. Like that, I thought that was pretty interesting too. That they, at least the Zaporozhian Cossacks, especially because they were there on the on the Dnieper River, which is
Dnieper. Yes,
Dnieper. Excuse me, I'm such an American. but they became so, you know, very adept at you know, river sort of river navigation. Which they then adapted into just, you know, on the open Black Sea.
The thing is that it was not an ethnicity, so to speak. It was a way of life, and they were very democratical and very violent.
Right.
It was like, really, kind of very like the pirates.
Yeah, especially in that sense of where the, you know, the Ataman or the, you know, the Hetman, like, if it's in combat, then his word is the law and you follow him, you know, whatever. If it's a combat situation, he's absolutely in charge. Any other time, you tell him to go fuck himself. No one cares. Which is very similar to that kind of the pirate democracy with the captain.
If he wants to order you around, he better give you some solid arguments why.
Right, right.
Eventually, as the Russian Empire got more centralized, then the Cossacks got like more and more kind of put under control, I would say. I don't know how to put this
exactly. I guess they started becoming sort of, what would you... They became more official, I guess? More institutional?
Right now, there are still Cossacks around, and I'll speak about modern Cossacks right now. But in the 19th century, especially before the Bolshevik Revolution, at the end of it, they become essentially like tribes who serve in the military of the Tsar, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, like they're basically like sort of... What sets them apart is that they had some sort of like they had different levels of conscription, or like they'd be like, when it came to like time to like raise soldiers, they had to raise more soldiers. But that, you know, that was kind of what was most distinctive about them at that point. This is actually, as the further we go along in the Cossack story, the less I know about it. So you'll have to tell me about it. But
no,
I think
no,
by that
fine.
Point, they would have been more settled too. This would have been, they would have had like sort of what we might call peasant agriculture as well, since they're settling all these formerly like open steppe lands and creating, you know, village agriculture.
Yeah. As the steppes arrive, they do become more and more settled, but they settle basically in the territory of Ukraine, and then some, I just say, not so nice things happen. Because, yeah, even though I kind of like things, basically the idea was like this, you know, they are these independent steppe guys who are basically kind of allies slash vassals to this. But then the Russian Revolution happens, and in the Civil War that was like following the Russian Revolution, there were Cossacks on both sides of the fighting, and like a lot of these officers and experienced Cossacks, because you know they are a military unit after all. That's their primary point at this point. Because the 19th century Tsar basically meant that you registered as a Cossack, you have more or less independence, but you are in the army now. Okay, but a lot of these guys fought for the White Army. Some of the very poor ones joined the Red One. And as the White Army lost, there was something called Raskazochivanie, or in English, decossackization. That took place on the surviving Cossacks and their homelands, as they were viewed as a potential threat to the new regime. Their territory was divided amongst other divisions of the army and people, and was given to like other republics or minorities. Their territory was also like actively encouraged to be populated by other people. They were massively arrested. They had violent repressions. This was basically, especially on the Cossacks in Ukraine, as the Cossack homelands were often very fertile. So during the collectivization campaign led by Stalin, many Cossacks were treated as kulaks.
Yeah, yeah, because they would have, I mean, they're sitting there.
They were shot instantly.
Yeah, yeah.
The famine of 1933, for example, hit the Don and Kuban territories a lot, and according to one Michael Kort, a historian that I use, quote, during the 1919 and 1920, out of a population of approximately 3 million, the Bolshevik regime killed or deported an estimated 500,000 Cossacks.
Wow.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, you know, as they helped out and as they were independent and free-thinking and, God forbid,
right.
Democratic.
Right. Well, that's one thing I think is really, really very, well, I think it's part of the sort of the, I guess, the wider tragedy almost of the way the Russian Revolution shook out, is that you have these Cossacks, and you can see, I mean, it makes sense that some Cossacks would go over to the Reds, some over to the Whites, because in the Cossack identity, you have that kind of, that radical egalitarianism, that anti-authoritarianism, that was behind so much of the 1917, of the February Revolution, you know, behind so much of the kind of upwelling against these repressive czarist apparatus of state. And yet at the same time, of course, the Cossack identity is wrapped up in service to the Tsar. So that kind of, I can see that tension.
And also, it's wrapped up to, you know, being being individuals,
right.
being like trusting to themselves. No Cossack would follow like some Leninist doctrine and believing.
And that, yeah, exactly. Stuff. So they would have, you know, and that's one thing that's, you know, about the sort of the extremely complicated history of the Russian Revolution is that, you know, before the Bolsheviks really solidified their, you know, their hold on the entire revolution itself, that you did have a lot more of these radical democratic elements at work in it. And it's such
Well, the interesting thing is that this is also the period, by the way, you know, you in America have this, like, I don't know, you play cowboys and Indians as kids, right?
yeah. It's a little less common nowadays that, you know,
I know, right? But technically cowboys and Indians.
Yeah.
Well, over here in the Soviet era, that the same game was called Cossacks and Razbojniks, or Cossacks and Robbers.
Oh, wow. Huh, yeah. I guess that kind of makes sense, yeah.
Literally, you were Cossacks and robbers, or Kazaki Razbojniki.
Yeah.
Kids still play today. It's like, you know, when you have to split up.
Right. Yeah, it's just, you know, a game that you play where you're two opposing teams. You just call each other whatever you call each other. Yeah.
Over here was that one.
Yeah. And that's interesting. That's, you know, making a distinction between a Cossack and a robber, because the early Cossacks were the one and the same.
They could have called game Cossacks and, you know, other
Cossacks and Cossacks. Yeah, but that's the, I think that's sort of a, like I said, kind of wrapped up in the wider strategy of the Russian Revolution, is that that kind of like radical democratic impulse, that anti-authoritarian impulse among the Cossacks, really it was in step with a lot of what a lot of other people were reaching for before the Bolsheviks really got their stranglehold on everything. And it's especially sort of, It would have been a sort of an almost a native Russian tradition of democracy to draw on, you know, if you were building a new democratic state. But instead, of course, that's not how it went, and of course the Cossacks got de-Cossackized. But
But the thing again,
yeah,
is that like this World War I thing always leads to World War II, right? And in the meantime, as there was a large population of Bolsheviks, of Jews in the Bolshevik kind of, you know, part of it. Because at that time, if you were an Eastern European Jew, you were either a Zionist or a Bolshevik, essentially. Those movements attracted Jews. Yeah. It's not like a lot of people, like a lot of these alt-right conspiracy theorists, like to think that Jews created Bolshevism. It was not so. It was just that Bolshevism attracted Jewish minorities because it gave them some hope of self-expression.
Right.
You should listen to Martyrmaid's that Israel-Palestinian conflict to understand this better. But essentially, Jews at the time were like extremely attracted to the situation, and a lot of the Cossacks blamed, as Ukraine today, especially cities of Odessa near the Black Sea, have a huge Jewish population. Yeah, a lot of Cossacks did blame Jews for the communist regime.
Yeah.
And a lot of Jews blamed Jews for the killing of their own people. So they did a lot of pogroms.
Right.
There were massive pogroms committed against the Jews by the Cossacks because the Cossacks blamed the Jews for the success of communist regime. There we have it. Dear folks, we have history where everyone slaughters everyone because they blame each other.
Exactly. Everyone slaughters everyone instead of understanding the things that the cause that they have in common. But where would history be without these tragedies and misunderstandings, I guess?
Yeah, but this is what happened because, you know, due to this fact, because that all happened at least up until 1937 when Stalin killed all the Jews.
Yeah.
Because in 1937, Stalin did his massive purges and killed everyone in the Soviet leadership who wasn't ethnically Russian or who was even remotely kind of, you know, everyone who said anything bad about him whenever.
Right. Doing a really great job of purging his whole state of like talented people right before they faced, you know, a massive war. But anyway, that guy,
not exactly talented, by the way. I have read Daniel, and I'll mention this in future episodes.
Yeah.
Some of the idea that he purged the talented people, that's not quite correct. He purged dangerous people, yes, and on a racial basis, but. But I will tell you that, for example, Mr. Tukhachevsky, whom he purged, wanted to turn Russia into a World War I tank-producing factory in 1939.
Oh, good.
It's a complicated issue. Yeah. There, I'm not sure I know the truth. I'm just being, you know, this.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, when World War II broke out, again, Cossacks found themselves, guess what, on both sides of the conflict.
Hmm.
Most fought for the USSR. However, a lot of them also chose, like about 40%, chose to basically collaborate with Germans because, hey, those are the Soviets. They murdered everyone I love and knew about.
Right, right. I mean, it's kind of that same choice that so many ethnic minorities in the Soviet Union had to face. Where
exactly? Because right, yeah. You know, whom do you fight against? And then again, they also committed some very terrible right. acts. Some of them, at least. I wouldn't blame all Cossacks on this. Like I don't blame every Soviet citizen for the crimes of Stalin.
Of course not. Right. But at the same time, you have to recognize the culpability of, like, there were Cossacks who helped carry out, you know, these awful
acts.
There were
also Latvians who did this and whatever, but yeah. And the idea was that a lot of them did, and that was, like, massive and bloody. At the end of this, Stalin, after the end of World War II, because, you know, Cossacks went on both sides of the war, they were fighting for each other's side, and by this point, Cossack means you're basically born into this, because you don't really join the Cossacks at this point. You can join Cossacks now, which we'll get to, but by this point, you're born into this community. Yeah. But after the war was over, in 1949, in the Second Great Purge, guess who got sent to gulags in, like, huge numbers?
I would imagine it's our friends, the Cossacks.
Yeah, because Cossack culture, as famous and important in general Russian culture as it was, the Soviets didn't like independence that
right.
much. And this is the part of the Cossack that you don't hear. Like I said, there are other podcasts who made episodes about Cossacks, about their history in the earlier ages, but none of them spoke about what happened with the Cossacks. Yeah. During kind of more modern days. And what happened with them was that they were thoroughly politicized.
Hmm. Yeah.
There were those who collaborated were turned into tools of the regime. Those who didn't were sent to gulags and sent right. off. Be it like Stalin posed with his Cossack hat with the Cossacks, because he was from Caucasus region, which was like nearby. They became very different from what they were. And even right now, they have like internal contracts about this. But I want to get to modern day a bit later on. But yeah, these are proud people, proud community of people, essentially land pirates.
Right.
Who, well, did a lot of terrible things, suffered a lot of terrible things. I don't even know. I was kind of hoping to give a report on them that, you know, they were the good guys, that they were kind of actually the bad guys. No, they're not. No one's really in history the good guys
right.
or the bad guys.
Right. Yeah, it's always... exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, you know, leadership, it's actually very easy to find among leadership who the real bad guys are. But again, when you're talking about, like, these enormous, you know, enormous groups of human beings, like, it's... Of course it's going to be varied because human beings are varied and they bring various things to the table. It's... But yeah, even specifically, like, with the group, like you said, like, Cossacks, like, you know, like, oh, we're going to find out who's, you know, were they good guys or bad guys? And I think when you start to get serious at all about trying to understand history, you ditch the idea of good guys and bad guys pretty quick. Like, that's... Because it's not a very useful way of trying to understand what happened in the past. But, it's at the same time it's hard to resist that, especially when you have, like, you know, very obvious and you know, obvious atrocities like those committed by, you know, Stalin and the Soviet leadership, or, you know, the Nazi leadership, or I think it was Khmelnytsky. I forget which Cossack revolt it was, but it's very well remembered among sort of the Jewish historical traditions, like, and it was kind of a folk memory in Jewish oral tradition of just how devastating this, you know, 1600s Cossack raids were throughout Poland. You know, it was Poland and Lithuania, just, you know, laying waste to entire, you know, communities of Jewish people. And, but yeah, you're right. Like, it's a cycle of, you know, victimized and victimizer, and it becomes sort of an you know, gosh, you really did it, Chris. This is Eastern Border, right? We gotta get sad.
I'm sorry, Daniel. Okay, this is like, you know, welcome, comrade Daniel. We sit in like our red corner in our nice cabinet, but always remember that there are nice men from the KGB in the back.
Exactly, but I think what's interesting is that despite what the Soviet Union tried to do to wipe out the Cossack identity, like, it has had a resurgence. And that's something I don't know a lot about, except that, are these people who actually are descended from Cossack families, or are they people who kind of adopted the Cossack identity, or, like, what's...
They are very tribal people.
Yeah.
There are people who have grown up in the commune, but I will now... Okay, see, I can judge the Cossacks in various ways, in positive and negative, yeah. both, and I have done so in this episode so far. Right now, I will power a bunch of fucking shit on modern Cossacks' heads, and no one will fucking stop me from doing so, because they make me mad.
Yeah.
First of all, modern Cossacks are a fucking crime to humanity and a shame to everyone else, especially those guys who wrote the letter to the Ottoman Sultan.
Yeah.
Right now, they are pro-Putin, pro-Russian government thing. They have literally paid for and opened a fucking bust, like, you know, a copper bust, mm-hmm. to Putin and opened it, a monument for him.
Huh.
They praise Putin as a messenger from God, literally.
Wow. Huh.
They beat up protesters on the streets. They are essentially a paramilitary force,
yeah.
whose leaders get paid by the Russian government to beat up protesters, kill journalists, and, you know, extort money from people opposed to the regime.
Oh, I was gonna say, like, it's like it almost sounds like they're kind of like it's almost like a kind of mafia criminal syndicate, but. But tied in with the official government? Or?
It's about that. Essentially, they have... basically, they get leeways from the law. They can't get arrested. At the same time, they have a lot of tax exemptions and whatever, and they have to follow their kind of hitman still. For that, they have to do some dirty work.
Yeah.
They're paid criminal organizations right now. And you know what's the worst part about the situation? The worst part is a lot of them just pile upon pile fake military orders on themselves, and they'd like to present themselves as... huge World War II veterans, and it's like, Didi Vayevali, like, our fathers fought for this stuff, so if you see a Cossack, he'll have, like, 19, 20, whatever, tons and tons of medals on himself, praising Stalin, and saying that, oh, his fathers fought for World War II. Most of those medals are fake, he had nothing to do with it, they bought those medals. They're faking, right now, they're trying to present themselves as these cool fighters against fascism, for the Soviet Union, and for Putin,
right.
even though they're actually basically just, you know, they have become Tsar's thugs by this point.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
And that is so fucking miserable. And there are actually some real Cossacks who still, you know, who are like living on the border towns and who are ethnically like this. Because it's one of the few cases where culture became an ethnicity in a way.
Right, yeah. Okay. It's interesting that it's through, we have a historical record of this culture becoming like an ethnicity being born almost.
Yeah, and you know, there are some real Cossacks who still kind of try to keep their independence, but they get beaten up by pro-Putinist Cossacks.
Wow.
Today. Yeah. And it's like, you know, being the guys who were super anti-authoritarian, who were basically punks of the 17th century.
Right.
And now they're, like, they put up their own monument to Putin. They declared him an Orthodox right. saint.
Right, like they're there and they're bending the knee to this, you know, new czar and just
bending the knee to the little Vovochka is the fucking most miserable thing that you can do, and I'm sorry about this, okay? Yeah.
Well, you know what, Chris, I don't think anyone who listens to your show is going to think that you have any other attitude toward Putin and his regime.
Dude, I do have some valid reasons for this, okay?
I was gonna say, there's, you have valid and personal reasons to not want to have any truck with that. Yeah, it is particularly kind of, and I guess, and it's another sort of thing, like you sort of look at the historical development of various groups and, you know, groups that have been subject to, you know, intense persecution or other kind of trauma and violence. And it's almost like, on the one hand, I can understand sort of coming out the other side and seeing an opportunity at self-preservation in aligning yourself with this power, but at the same time, it is extremely depressing.
For the most part, I think that those guys who are now collaborating with the regime there, they're not really Cossacks. They're just using the name. You know, it's a brand
right, right.
now.
It's a, yeah, it's a brand instead of a culture or an ethnicity. It's a brand. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Dude, you know, traditional Russian dance that, you know, it's been in Rocky IV. It's been, like, everywhere. You know, the one where you have your hands crossed and you sit down while, like, kneeling and, you know, kicking.
Yeah, you do the kicking. And,
yeah, that motion. But when you have this weird hat on your head and stuff, that's all Cossack stuff. That is all Cossack traditions. Right. That is 100% Cossack. Except that, for some reason, people outside of, you know, post-Soviet places or Russia tend to automatically associate everything Cossack with Russian. While it was really
with
not
Russians,
the case.
Right.
Well, for example, when Cossacks were really yeah. active in the 18th, 19th century, the main Russians were either serfs, and those guys were just too busy trying to feed themselves to think about any kind of culture, or yeah. you were in the nobility, and then you were trying to be as French as humanly possible.
Right. Yeah, to the extent that, like,
no,
yeah,
seriously.
At the time of the revolution, there were aristocrats who didn't speak Russian at all. They only spoke French, and they couldn't actually talk to any serfs.
Exactly. Okay, so this... It's kind of... I would call it a usurpation of Cossack identity, because, you know, Cossacks
yeah, yeah.
were, like you said, Cossacks were Soviet cowboys, and, you know, they're kind of cool.
Right.
And they're complicated, but let's ignore that part. And so let us just, you know, the Cossacks are cool. Let's show to the Americans that we have, we're Cossacks, yes. Clap your hands if you believe.
Right. It's, yeah, as,
I'm
sorry, as with everything,
we have come to the deep cynicism of Eastern.
Well, you know what, Chris? I mean, that's what the people come for. It's if you spend any amount of time actually deeply studying any topic in history, you come away with it like, well, there's good and there's bad. And it's not that simplistic, but it's, you know, it's...
In general, about history, you see, when we speak about these Cossacks, we can see the usurpation of this ideology, we can see both mm-hmm. glorification of these people and their deep tragedy at the same time. Mm-hmm. I think, like you mentioned here, I don't believe in any... Like, I have learned enough about history to just stop believing in the Golden Ages. That's my theory...
My
theory goes like this, okay? See... what we learned from previous ages was written by their kind of elite, right? So,
right.
as we read the histories of the past, it would be like someone from the future would read like only the memoirs of, say, Barack Obama or something.
Exactly, or like, you know, like
yeah.
Or
what
like
we
Warren
read
Buffett or Jeff
is
Bezos,
the glorified, the glorified versions of the retellings of what happened, where it is obviously where everyone obviously tried to make everyone look more cultural, more nice, and more pleasant than they actually were. We read the upper crust of upper crust telling about how the upper crust did things, how everyone else basically died.
I very much though agree with the I think honestly that's one if as long as we're talking very like general stuff here, I think that's one reason why it's fascinating whenever we get any kind of glimpse into, well, this is why I think archive work is so important, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of like say the original research that you do for your show is so important, because the cool thing when I was in library school, what the sort of archives were explained as. Archives are the preservation of elements that no one ever thought would be important enough to preserve. Or rather, that's one element of archives. And that's so vastly important whenever you're looking into history. If you can find stuff that no one ever thought would be saved, or no one would bother to take care of, to pass down, that is such an excellent window into what was actually going on. And you can piece together a lot more of sort of what... You can piece together a lot more of what life must have been like for the people who actually had to live in those societies, to create those societies for those elites to then, dance around in and say that they were doing it. But I think it's It is something to always be cognizant of. You're absolutely right. That, like, remember...
That's exactly right about the archives, because, you know, my latest episode was about the... was about exactly about, like, this archive document, the regulations of the KGB, and that came straight from the archives. I'm not sure the guys who wrote it even
exactly.
thought it would work
it's
out.
It's the kind of... If you get your hands on stuff that no one ever thought anyone would bother to look at, that can be such an amazing window in such a way, because it's, you know...
That's way more real than the stuff that was written intentionally as a history to be read.
It's the stuff that it's the stuff that no one thought was going to try to polish it. You know, it's unvarnished, I guess. I don't know quite how to put it, but yeah.
At least they'll have podcasts in the future generations.
They will. They'll have the podcast. They'll be able to look back and say, like, ah, well. Those guys sure seem to be having a good time, but I don't know what they were talking about, but they seem like they're enjoying it.
Well, okay, let's wrap this up, Daniel. Thank you for this. And dear listeners, dear comrades, this is Daniel. You probably have heard him before if you've listened to all the episodes of the show.
Yeah.
Go listen to Cannonball. Subscribing to Cannonball is mandatory.
Well, thank you much, Chris, and hey, keep doing what you're doing with the show. It's absolutely tremendous. You do important work, and I'll talk to you again, man.
Yeah, thank you, and до свидания, товарищи.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you. This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.